How do we build in the forge? Is that an anvil?
That's a hammer and anvil I've got.
It's tongs and like a hot horseshoe, right?
Yep, and one of those billows.
A bellows?
A billows, a bellows. Live from the Mundangerous Stacks in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 191 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're headed to the library so the GM can dump a lot of lore in our laps. But we're actually excited about it because it's going to be a great session. But first, the Rogue Traders attend another dinner party in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Bookworm can't wait to get its claws into a dusty tome in the Character Creation Forge.
Gather round, travelers, to hear our tale. Venture Maidens is an actual play 5th edition podcast made by 4 longtime friends and lifetime gamers. We take our role-playing as seriously as we keep our bulges tasteful. So if you're looking for an epic high fantasy tale spun by a killer cast, give us a shot. We publish new episodes every other week and live stream our game recordings on Twitch. Now get on out there and download Venture Maidens wherever podcasts are free. Hope to see you in the community. And don't forget to venture away.
All right, so before we get started, do you have a bit of news, some good news and some bad news? So unfortunately, one of our longtime friends of the show, Jeff Aldrich, who's one of the hosts of the System Mastery podcast, has taken ill. He recently had a daughter and more recently has found himself in the hospital with a frankly terrifying blood pressure. Something that he described, or the doctor described, as the resting heart rate of a cocaine addict.
Which he is not.
No, he's not. So anyway, it's a really scary time for somebody who's been a friend of our show. He's actually the person who pulled together the original draft of the Character Creation Forge for us. He listened to every single episode to pull all of that information out.
Unfortunately, Jeff needed to decide between getting health insurance for his newborn daughter or for himself, and he chose his daughter.
Which is a good choice.
Excellent choice, but of course that means that he is going to have exorbitant hospital bills. I think he was in the ICU for 3 days. He's still basically on bed rest at home.
Right.
So there is a GoFundMe. We've got the link in the show notes, but it is bit.ly/livingmastery.
Yeah, he's set a goal of $25,000. He's very, very close to that goal. Almost, actually, now 400 people have donated to him, amongst which include us. But, you know, if you have anything extra to give, Jeff has been just a great person in this community. And if you've got a way to support him, if you have a few extra dollars, I know he would really appreciate it.
Yeah. Even if he does hit that goal, like, please continue to give, because that's just an arbitrary number. His actual hospital bills are probably going to be much higher than that. For those of you outside the United States, we don't have universal health care here.
Yeah, the overwhelming response has been, I'm Canadian, I don't understand. Or, yeah. Oh no, here's money.
yeah, I mean, this is a decision, I think, or this is a dice roll that a lot of us have made in the past. Like, I went without health insurance for 10 years, and like, I fortunately got out of it with just a couple broken bones that never got set, which is far better than the position Jeff is in right now. So, you know, whatever anyone can do will help a lot.
So on to the good news. Launching this week is the Kickstarter for the 2019 edition of Akatacon, which is one of my favorite conventions and one that I have attended every year, except for the year where I missed my flight and could not get there.
It is definitely your favorite convention in Ohio.
It is 100% the only convention I would go to in Ohio. So it is occurring on November 8th through November 10th of 2019. That's Friday to Sunday in Dayton, Ohio. Michael, the host of the RPG Academy podcast, puts it on and organizes it. There's usually hundreds of people in attendance, but in order to raise money to book the venue and different things, he runs a Kickstarter to pre-sell badges. So if you would like to attend, it's a great way to get a badge a little bit cheaper than you would through the regular sales. If you'd like to sponsor it in some way, which is another thing we usually do, you know, you can have your name on a table topper or in the program, different things like that.
So there's a link in the show notes if you're interested. So now back to more bad news. Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And on the Death World Iblis Prime, in the frontier city of Meridian, the Rogue Traders have set out to establish a colony in the name of the Holy Throne of Terra and Prophet. And after tracing the sabotage in their minds back to the Technogangers, the crew have switched from rogue mode to traitor mode and are now preparing for the pending arrival of a small Kroot fleet.
Yes, this is one of the benefits of being rogue traders in that we can have these kinds of interactions with horrible, terrible Xenos.
Oh, yes.
The Kroot, if you don't recall, are small. Are they small? They seem small. They look
pretty
like
small.
Kobold-y shape.
Yeah,
but they're like reptilian avian pack hunters with really good weapons.
Yep,
which Trank is excited for, and they also eat people.
Yeah, their whole deal is that they absorb the DNA of various species that they hunt in order to make themselves better hunters.
Right, which is not how digestive tracts work, but whatever.
Well, they have their mages basically do that. They use the warp for this.
Yes, they have tiny mages in their stomach lining.
So upon arrival of the Kroot fleet, the His Enduring Light immediately hails them for an audience. And they're granted one. So the Rogue Traders are accompanied by their full honor guard, as well as their Dark Eldar bosun, Sarith, who you may recall is a former Dark Eldar incubus who decided to come along with them in their very first prison escape adventure.
Right, and who now runs
Discipline.
The discipline detail on the ship.
Or at least punishment.
Right. Look, most people get out alive.
Right. Most people keep their limbs mostly intact.
So the Kroot, of course, not being shaped in the glorious form of man, are blunt. They're a bit insulting, honestly, although they're polite about it. And they're kind of preening, almost like grown-up birds.
Mm-hmm. And they... You weren't ready for this, I think, when you first got on board, and then you were immediately reminded of this fact by Echo. But Kroot humor is extremely driven by irony. So naturally, they offer the Rogue Traders a banquet in their honor, wherein they serve some of the most exquisite and rare preparations you have ever seen of what is almost certainly human flesh.
This, it smells really good, which is very disconcerting.
Very unsettling. It's not unsettling to one person, though. Sarith, the bosun, who is enthusiastically appreciative of this.
I mean, he doesn't really see us as people, so it's not cannibalism to him. Which he's a little disappointed by.
Right. And as the Kroot stare expectantly, enjoying the looks on your faces as you slowly realize what they've served you, your rogue trader, Silva Lionheart, does not shy away. In fact, in order to prove her mettle, she sits there and calmly, one bite by bite, eats her dinner while conducting negotiations.
Yeah, the rest of us, we drink the wine. That's about it.
Exactly.
Of course, you know, we're hungry now, but dinner still proceeds, and we begin to come to some loose terms for a trade of our ore that we've been able to mine, as well as corpses of Emerald Stalkers.
The genetic material, right? Like, that's the value of the Emerald Stalkers.
Right, so they can consume it. In exchange for Kroot weapons, which are really nice. But it does reach a snag when the Kroot, at the very last minute, decide that we need to throw in the honor guard on our part of the deal.
Yeah, like just all of them. Just leave them here. They'll be fine. Mm-hmm. They're ours now.
Nothing bad will happen to them.
So this was one of the most entertaining debates that you guys have deliberated on in the course of Rogue Trader, both telepathically and out loud. All of you are weighing in on the literal value of a pound of flesh and trying to weigh that against damage to morale and morality, as it were.
This was, yeah, a very strange conversation for me to be having, because for the very first time, Trank is sort of like the one who's putting a stake in the ground and saying, no, this is the line. We're going no further.
Yeah, we will not condemn 100-some-odd Honor Guard armsmen to their deaths.
Well, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. It's that...
Well, I won't sell them. Death,
right, to be eaten by Xenos.
Right.
I mean, if they're being sold for some other purpose, I don't know, maybe...
You would happily sacrifice them to fight these Xenos in a losing gambit, but you would absolutely not sacrifice them for profit.
Yeah, I will say, attack right now and we will all die heroic. Well, they will all die heroically.
The human resources department would not approve of wasting our human resources.
Right. I mean, all their gear too, really? It's a lot of guns.
So... ultimately, you guys did decide that you were not willing to leave the Honor Guard behind.
I'm pretty sure Trank insisted that he would start shooting some people if we tried to leave the Honor Guard behind to the ridiculous Xenos and their weird heresy.
Right, you would have had to leave the Honor Guard and Trank behind. So the Kroot do allude to the fact that they intend to take another meeting with a major trade partner, and... ultimately, you guys let the deal collapse, right? Like, you're just unwilling to cross that line, but decide that what you can do is foil their trade negotiations with their other partner and then revisit the Kroot to get more favorable terms.
Yeah, if we can't have this trade deal, nobody will have this trade deal.
I love this. I think this is the most Rogue Traderly thing you've done, which was like, cool, we walked away from the deal because we weren't going to make a bad one. And then we pivot to, but you're not going to get a deal out of this anyway. You'll be back.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where I think both sides were a little surprised at the way that the negotiation panned out, but then it spun out into something more interesting. So, like, I think you were confused at first that we wouldn't just give over the armsmen.
I was, yeah. I was very surprised by that. You draw weird moral lines.
Yeah, yes. It was sort of nice to find out where Trank's line actually was. He was like, wait, no, that's a terrible idea. We're not doing that. And then I think we were surprised that the Kroot wouldn't give in. Like, they were like, no, we want the armsmen. And we thought, all right, we'll push back. We'll negotiate in some way. We'll give them something else that they want. But there wasn't anything else they wanted. They wanted to humiliate us by taking the armsmen. Mm-hmm. We said, oh, no. No, we don't get humiliated and we can help it.
Yeah, no, that was the most surprising thing, I think, was... I mean, for me, I knew there was a chance you rejected it, and I kind of had some ideas of what could go on next. But I don't think we've ever had that sort of thing in an RPG where we typically, move forward, the plot seems to be, gaining momentum in this direction, and then it's just, it falls apart. It just fails, right? And now we've got to regroup and figure out what do we do next. And you guys pivoted real quickly, which I was really proud of. But usually in games, you don't let that happen, right?
Yeah, it was a nice there wasn't meta chatter. It was a nice in character moment of no, we're not doing this. Okay, what do we do? Well, I know. Let's screw them.
Yeah, exactly. We can still get what we want here. We just have to go a more roundabout way. So, at any rate, the Kroot are disappointed, but remain exceedingly polite and offer you a parting gift of, as you mentioned, shall we call it mysterious jerky, which is accepted gleefully by Sereth.
Yeah.
So, later that night, Echo and Flare have returned to the His Enduring Light, and they examine the Vox traffic and identify the most likely major buyer, the Watchtower.
I will say very quickly that this is one of the benefits of playing a game where you're not out trying to save the universe, where, you can just get derailed and now we'll just undertake a revenge mission because, why not? We're not on a timeline where everybody dies.
Right. I mean, until you are.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely it's coming. And we'll find out exactly how next week. So this week we are talking about going to the library, which is a great deal of fun in pretty much any game, but it's sometimes hard to pull off because we've got a question from listener Chris. He says, so one of the challenges of campaigns that incorporate politics, history, and prophecies, looking at you, Eberron, is that there's so much story and information to get into your PC's hands and heads. But my episodes in the Regal Library of Regalport are, despite the drow librarian and his dog-sized scorpion, not as exciting or revelatory as I would like them to be, and I don't want to just use, quote, the library as a gigantic clearinghouse for plot hooks.
He continues, listening to the Morning Glory recaps, you often mention trips to the library. I think it would be a great show to hear how you handled these, made them interesting and exciting, and conveyed information to your players without having them just make investigation, history, arcana, or religion checks, and then just handing over exposition.
Chris is right here in everything except that it will be a great show.
Right. It'll be a thoroughly mediocre show.
Here we are.
Welcome to the middle third.
The middle of a middling show.
Right. All right, so let's kind of break this into how we did it in our games. And it's not just Morning Glory, right? We've definitely had library sessions in our long-running Dark Sun game, as well as even in Rogue Trader. So we can kind of draw from all those examples. And then I think there's probably a few other tips that we can talk about that haven't necessarily applied to us, but would be good to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think it was surprising sort of, you know, looking back through our games that we played, like, how often we do go to the library or undertake research. Like,
yeah,
as a group, all of us are like, I don't know, maybe we should look into this. Can we make some knowledge checks?
Yeah, well, I think that's actually a common theme for the games that we play, is that knowledge exists, but often it's been lost or sequestered or needs to be like rediscovered, right? Like, it's not necessarily a quest for true discovery. It's a quest of figuring out what civilization has already figured out. And then just advancing that.
Yeah, this is sort of part and parcel of most of the settings that a lot of us play in, right? If you play a fantasy setting, probably there's a long-lost knowledge from the ancient days or the first age of the world. If you're in a post-apocalyptic setting, like, you know, how did the world end and, like, what lost technology was there? It comes up a lot.
If you're playing 40K, it's both.
Right.
as well as lots of knowledge that hasn't been lost, but has been actively sequestered in order to prevent people from gaining access to it, right? Which is basically the role of the Inquisition.
Yeah, and you have this built-in antagonist slash occasional ally in whatever organization is sequestering that information. You know, it might be at some point, like... the party needs that information, and it's helpful to the people who are keeping it hidden. And, you know, in the early parts of the game, they're certainly doing their best to prevent it from getting out.
Yeah. So one of the ways that we often incorporated this was that the library usually ended up being part of a knowledge or religion check we made. And it was like, you don't know the answer to that question, right? You don't know what this is, but you do know the place that would probably have the answer, right? So either the players would ask the question and roll the check for where can we go to find this, or the GM would put it forward as like, oh yeah, you've never heard of this. Like, you have no idea what the Red Hand Syndicate is, but if there's any place that would have records about necromantic organized crime, it's the Royal Library in Reckonmark.
Yeah, this is a great way to kick this information down the road when, as a GM, you have no idea what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Your players are like, oh, I'm going to make some knowledge checks. And you're going, yeah, all right, I'm familiar with this lore. No big deal. They do really well. And you're going, oh, crap. I don't remember. Or, wow, I really need to look in this. Or, I have no idea because I haven't created this yet. You know what? Let's take a little trip to the library that is in another city, and
tomorrow,
when you get there, there will be information.
Right, yeah. I bet you'll get there roughly next session. and then the other way that we kind of access this a lot is through downtime activities, right? So for my character in Morning Glory Brand, that was something that I just invested a lot of my downtime in developing, was the library as a resource for the party. Mostly by regaining my permission to access the library as a member of the Inquisition.
Right, very quietly. Did they remove my pass when they exiled me? No,
right.
They weren't that thorough? Okay, good.
It's called excommunicated, all right? It's a religious organization.
Yeah, and using library time as a downtime activity prevents your main session from getting bogged down in constant trips to the library. So you can have a game that is really steeped in lore and lore that needs to be unearthed, but you can just sort of have one person doing that, or you know, everybody doing it, but in between sessions, so that you don't have to roleplay it out every single time. You can just do it the first few times or when there are actual interactions in the physical library.
Yeah. So another way that we make the library kind of more of an exciting thing is to make access to the library a reward, right?
Yeah, I think the first task is usually finding the library, right? There's that initial check and you're finding, oh, which library do I need to go to? Okay, that's relatively simple. But in something like 40K, there's the black library inside the webway, right?
Yep.
Where like all this information is stored and like one, people don't even really know it exists. But like if it does exist, where the hell is it?
Mm-hmm.
But even if it's like a normal library, it's like the grand library in the middle of the city and you can just walk in, you're not always necessarily guaranteed access, at least not to all the stacks and probably not to the restricted section, like a la Harry Potter.
Right. Yeah. So you might have some type of encounter in order to even gain that access, right? There might be guards or docents or librarians or whomever inside, or likewise, gaining the knowledge within the library might be punishable itself, right? Like knowing the knowledge of the restricted section might make you a traitor or a heretic or whatever that prevents you from being able to continue to exist normally in society.
Yeah, this is a good chance for you to bring in the entire party. Like you may very well have party members who do not care about the library and like understand that the information contained in is important to the quest, but just have no skills around knowledge and are just sort of along for the ride. Great. Maybe they're the one who like lies your way into the stacks or distracts the librarian while someone is actually doing research in the forbidden section.
Right.
Like Ron Weasley is not there to do research. Ron Weasley is there to cause a ruckus.
Right. Ron Weasley exists to get kicked out.
Yes. Success.
You can also make the library a reward by making it a privilege for certain characters, right? Like for Bran, being an Inquisitor meant he got access to the library in Thrain.
Right. If you have the sage background in 5th edition, it might just be that, you know, everyone is confronted, but you're all allowed in because, oh, you are a sage. Of course you are welcome here. It's a nice moment for character choices to actually matter.
And then the other way to do it is, you know, if the characters go there early on in your campaign and get turned away because they're nobody or they don't have permission or whatever. Later on, if they come back, they might now have suitable renown and they would be welcomed and, you know, they would have the right to access it. That's a reward in and of itself.
Yeah, you show up with like all these books in your hands and you're like, you remember me? I came here earlier and you wouldn't show me to the library. Big mistake.
Yeah, here's my book toll. I've made my minimum contribution. Let me in the library. So another thing we found is, and this is a canonical thing, but in Dark Sun, the library itself was a challenge to be in. There's the Lost Library underneath the city of Tyr, which is like a shifting stacks and like impossible to navigate and filled with crazy people who are trapped there who want to attack you and various other like major threats. So even getting into the library to find what you need, difficult. And then when you're there, you know, the library itself is fighting against you.
Right. Even the books may try to trap you inside through, you know, hypnosis or like leading you to believe the correct information is inside them. If you just look one page further.
Just one more page. I'm so close. It's in the index. I can see it in the index.
I'm so hungry. I'm so thirsty, but I'm almost there.
This is my life now.
Even if the library itself isn't trying to attack your party, you do want to make it some sort of challenge if you're not just hand-waving or doing library time in downtime. You do want people to be making checks, and you do want to have the conversation, like have people talk out loud about what it is they're looking for, what kind of connections their character is making or attempting to make, and then guide them in that general direction depending on the information they're giving you and the rolls on the dice, either, you know, false connections or a path that the player may not necessarily have thought of, but that become apparent to the character who's actually in the building.
I think that's really important when you're giving players the information is like, start from what are the players looking for, right? make sure that you're giving them the information that the players have said is interesting to them, not just 2 pages of lore that you pulled out of the, like, the Eberron sourcebook, right, which is general information and maybe not relevant. You know, and the flip side, of course, if they fail on those rolls or do whatever, then they might have false information or they might have difficulty or fail to find what they're looking for specifically.
Yeah, I think practically in this kind of scenario, what I would do is I would take information from the Eberron sourcebook. And then I would physically tailor it, like rewrite parts of it or swap some bits of lore out or add additional parts from some other section of a different book, specifically geared toward, one, the campaign that I was creating, and then the information that the particular character slash player was looking for. So, you know, Lou was looking for information about the Dalkeer and, like, you know, what is she and, like, what are the Half-Bloods? And so I put the information that I wanted her to have and that was actually canon in the Morning Glory campaign into a document that ended up being, like, about a page, actually printed it out and, like, handed it as a prop in the, like, in session. But then in game, like, I talked about the highlights of that information so that, one, everybody at the table understood what it was, and two, so that she didn't need to just sit there reading, like, 500 words at the table and, like, not being part of the session.
Yeah, so 2 things there. One is props are awesome, especially if you've got information that you want the party to repeatedly reference, right? So whether that is just a page of text that is all, like, super relevant for what they're looking for, or it's like a diagram that's useful to them, or like a set of glyphs or a map or something like that they would have gotten out of their research, like, that's great for a long-term reference. And then the other thing is, when you have players asking you those questions, right, like as Lou is asking questions about the Dalkeer or whatever, you also have to keep in mind that you know what information is necessary for the plot to progress. You need to make sure you give that information to the players regardless of what they're asking for, right? So you need to work it into the questions they're asking, because, like, you don't want to punish... Like, if you want to encourage the players to use the library as a resource, you don't then want to punish them for forgetting to ask the critical question that they were there for, you know, or not asking it in the right way or whatever. You want to keep the plot moving.
Yeah, right. Like, the character has much more understanding of this particular topic. Like, they're probably obsessed with this topic, and it's all they do is think about it, and now they're finding it in the library. And, like, they're not going to miss... relevant information. The player, on the other hand, like, has a real life and maybe, like, hasn't been thinking about this topic for 6 months.
Yeah. So, like, you know, what Lou was looking for was general information about Dalkeer and Half-Bloods and Zoriat and whatever. What she needed to find was the specific conditions with which to kill a certain Dalkeer, which she happened to find while looking for that general information. Now, party, you have what you need. Go forth.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens in a real library, is you're looking for information, you're, like, combing through relevant texts. You don't always find what you're looking for, but you often find what you need.
Right.
Like, oh, you don't see that. Like, okay, you have a great arcana or history check, right? You don't see what you were looking for. Instead, you see this.
Right. So in terms of how you actually share that information and kind of piggybacking that, if the players are going through the hassle of visiting a library, give them a concrete reward, you know, like, make sure that they're clear that, like, either the knowledge they were looking for or the next step in the path or whatever is in their hands, right? They shouldn't go through the trouble of, like, going to the library and, like, making that the focus of a session and then be more puzzled by the information they got than when they started. Like, that just discourages them from bothering with the library.
Yeah, or if they are puzzled, it should be because they now have more leads than they had before and they're just not quite sure which one to follow first, right? You shouldn't walk out of the library going, I have no idea what to do now and we're just as lost. It's, okay, we could go to Reckonmark, we could go to Korth, we could go to Sharn, or we could try to go to the plains.
Right, yeah. You've got to firm up their options, even if they don't have the exact answer they're looking for. And then in terms of actually sharing the information, you kind of touched on this on how you kind of developed the prop, but I think it's a really good idea. One of the things Chris asked was, you know, how do I get all of this background lore into my players' heads when they're really focused on the current plot? And I think the answer to that is share the background and the foreground information at the same time, right? So you have to read one sentence of background in order to get one sentence of immediate relevant foreground information. So, like, an example is, like, you know, the information you gain is that 100 years ago, the king made a declaration, and he was deposed 20 years ago, but a cult that was dedicated to him went to ground around that time. You know, these are their markings and rituals, which sure sound very close to some of the evidence that you've gathered, right? Like, now you've learned a little bit of the background of the cult that you're chasing, as well as confirmed that, oh, yeah, this is our target.
Right. In the library, you need to take the new information that the party is finding and connect it to the old information that they already have, because players don't always have that information in their heads. If you've been handing them reams of like actual sheets of text, they're not necessarily going to have memorized all that like the GM may have. So, hey, you find this new bit of information. You know what that reminds you of? Like, be proactively, just come out and say, it reminds you of the thing you saw 6 months ago.
Right.
In fact, you think it's the exact same thing. This is the connection you were looking for.
Yep. And also, like, sometimes you just have to go through those reminders of, no, you're thinking of Ondaire, we're in Breland.
Yeah. Yeah, like, exactly. Like, you're a little confused about this.
Silly player, you've gotten the countries completely mixed up. Let me correct you. This is not a check. You're just being right-sized.
Yeah, it's not a problem at all to be like, actually, you think it's more like this other thing that is correct.
Exactly. Like, if players are drawing the wrong conclusions because they're not quite grasping all the information, you can just correct them pretty easily.
Yeah, this is like, so you get this kind of scene in a lot of TV shows where there's an ensemble cast, they're doing research, or like, aha, we've discovered a new bit of information, and then one person goes, oh, wait a minute, it's just like this thing. Okay, you can't count on someone in the party or like someone at the table on this particular like Thursday to be the person to be like, aha, I have made this connection, right? If no one does that, if no one volunteers it, the GM can just step in and make that connection because one of the like characters present makes that connection.
And then hopefully you're also revealing this information in a way that pulls the players in and prompts more questions, right? You want them to want more information, whether it's to help them on their immediate quest or because the background is so interesting, but you want them asking more questions so that you have a chance to continue giving them more data, right? More of your lore, more of your immersive setting, provided that they are begging you for more information. Like, now they're really into it, as opposed to, cool, like, I'm not going to read this 5-page document before we start session zero because I have anything better to do with my day.
And I took no knowledge skills.
Right.
So, like, I do not care.
You've noticed my trend, huh? If there's work to do up front, then I am a useful idiot.
Just point me in a direction. Right. Oh, wow. All these books to burn, huh? Well, we're not here to burn these books? Oh, well, then I have nothing to offer.
Well, then I guess it's going to be a cold night at the campfire.
Ron Weasley out. Okay, I will say, though, if you are lucky enough to get to the point where players are grasping for more information, they're really interested in the lore, be careful about giving them too much lore that then sends them off in random directions unless you're intending to do that. It's very easy in like a complicated setting like 40K or Eberron to, you know, have someone say, actually, well, is there a vampire that, you know, we might be looking for in like this area of the country? It is very likely that over the last like 8,000 years there has been a vampire there. If it's not relevant to the plot, don't bring it up. Or when you mention it as like a GM who's sort of saying in passing, oh yeah, you've heard about this thing, but you don't think it's really relevant and doesn't seem to really fit. Not, oh yeah, yeah, there definitely was. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have to do that a lot in 40K because things come up and people remember little tidbits or whatever of various lore from all of the various sources. And it's like, isn't there like a thing about the Kroot where they do this? And I'm like, okay, above the table. Yes, this is a thing that Kroot do. Here's a funny thing about them. 40K is wacko. But here's what you know about the Kroot in character. And here's what we're going to proceed for in Shane's 40K universe, because oh boy, would it take too much if we kept going down all of these individual paths.
Right. It turns out when you pay writers by the word, they create a lot of words. And sometimes a lot of that lore matches up with other stuff or reflects it or, I don't know, copies it.
Okay. So there was this guy named Matt Ward. And that guy definitely got paid by the word. And he really loved Ultramarines.
Cato Sicarius.
All right, so back to the library. Another thing that we do a lot in our games is add role-playing elements to the library itself, right? Chris mentioned that he has a drow librarian who has a
dog-sized scorpion pet, which is terrifying and awesome.
Which is cool. Right? You've got the recurring NPC. That's great, right? The librarian or the archivist or the docent or whomever, right? And the key then is to leverage... like make that connection with the players so that the players are excited to go like check in on what's going on with that weirdo drow scorpion librarian, right? Like get invested in that person. If you can make those NPCs important to the characters, then they have yet another reason to check in at the library.
Yeah, and this relationship evolves over time. When they first meet the librarian, probably the librarian is not the most helpful person. Because, like, who are you? I have no idea who you are. You just walked into my library. You look like adventurers, the kind of people who like to burn books.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're adventurers. I bet you come across a lot of strange wares, and I just really love Andarian brandy. And I just can't get it here. It'd be a shame. You know, it'd be real nice if somebody would just bring me some Andarian brandy.
Anyone.
Anyone at all, really.
Also, librarians are great quest givers. Especially early on, like, I'm looking for rare books. You look like the kind of person who comes across rare books.
I certainly could help you if you brought me a rare book, sir.
That's how it works here. That's how libraries work. You give me a book, and then you can take a book.
Right.
Right. What, you think you can just borrow it for free?
If you don't want the librarian gatekeeper, as Chris mentioned, he doesn't want it to be just a plot hook clearinghouse, right? You can also think like other people who use the library might become recurring NPCs. So a lot of libraries are filled with students who are doing research. So they might be, or just using the quiet space to study or things like that. You might see the same person there multiple times and strike up some type of relationship with that NPC. Also, authors and artists do a lot of research in libraries, as it turns out, and they tend to have large networks and, you know, are probably in a different space from the adventurers, but might be able to add richness to the world because of what they're working on or who they're working for, who's commissioned them or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And once you've seated all these NPCs, then you have the ability to, later on in the campaign, continue having information from the library or library sessions, even if the rest of the party is like off gallivanting in another galaxy or like fighting through a dungeon, because you have these allies who can then do that research for the party.
Hey, found this cool thing in the library the other day. Weren't you looking at this cult?
Right? Or like, let's contact our friend, the drow librarian, you know, whom we have cultivated over the last like 8 levels in like 3.5 years, and ask them to do a favor for us. Of course they will. Like, they're on our side and they'll get back to us in 3 sessions.
Yeah, right. Like, we're headed to Stormreach. But our research efforts continue with our buddy, the drow librarian.
Right.
And of course, like, as with any good NPCs, you can always threaten them later if you need to pull them back to the library.
You know, terrible earthquake. Canonically, libraries weak to earthquakes.
So another thing that Chris suggested is a problem is that library sessions can feel slow or stagnate the campaign because there's no action, right? They're not really moving forward. They're kind of resetting the objectives of the group. So one thing you could do there is find a way to create urgency in the library itself.
Right. So when you guys were running through the Pit of Five Sorrows, like literally running at top monk speed, hasted monk speed,
Right.
On the back of your Warforged monk.
Trying to escape Tiamat. Right. Or at least the guardians that keep Tiamat in her cage.
Right. The people who are like, no, that's a bad Tiamat.
Yeah. Get out of my pit.
Lou, of course, got distracted by two locations, the Prophetic Observatory, which is basically a library of the stars, mm-hmm. and then also the actual library where there were books and scrolls. I think you guys actually got holed up in a library behind a wall of force.
Yep.
And then you had, I think, maybe a minute while you were like trying to conjure a portal to get the hell out of there. But of course, the rest of you who were not conjuring the portal were like, well, I look at the books.
Okay, I take anything that looks expensive or old or important. Like, right, I'll take any scroll in a nice case. Yeah.
I stick them in this bag of holding. How many books can fit in a bag of holding?
Yeah, we fit five people in a bag of holding. How many books can we fit in there?
And at that point, it's just like, I'm rolling some random dice to see how many books you get, but I know exactly which books you're getting.
Right.
The ones that are useful for me. Also the cursed books.
In Dark Sun, we've actually had multiple library trips. The first one, even before we found the shifting library underneath Tyr, was searching for records of entry into Tyr, which was a large library, basically, of documentation of people coming and going through the city. So we had to, of course, kill some guards in order to get our way in, sneak past the front desk attendant, who was effectively the librarian, and then do our search to find the records we were looking for, all before anybody noticed those dead guards and decided to come looking as to what had happened.
I mean, do you remember what happened after we killed the guards?
We killed the librarian next.
Yeah, that's a bit blasphemous, I think, for probably most of our listenership.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to, but we kind of had to.
We had a loose end, and the librarian wasn't playing ball with us. Also, we're Dark Sun, we're bad people.
Well, that's when we were like, oh, we're bad people.
Yeah. That was before we murdered all those children for the greater good.
Before you did. Before that, the party had only murdered one child.
And its own party member. We had the same thing in Rogue Trader, actually. If you recall, in the Verza house, while you were desperately trying to defend the ramparts from the invading enemies, you had like half the party out dying on the ramparts, while Flair and Trix were in a library deep within, digging through books, trying to figure out how to get this generator restarted.
Right, on the comm beads, it's just, read faster!
Yeah, exactly. Wait, I think we've got it. Wait, shut up. I can't focus. This sure looks a lot like it. Also, it looks like a dragon eating its own tail.
Now, it is probably best not to spend an entire session just doing research at the library, which is why, of course, I am a big fan of fights in the library.
Mm-hmm. Places where you can't just use fireball.
Or you can, and man, that is fun. yeah, it's a nice tension, actually, between like people who are looking for information, people who are trying to prevent that information from being found. One good way to do that is to just destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, libraries are very easy to draw if you don't have a pre-made map.
Oh, yeah, they tend to be just large square rooms with tables in the middle.
And the stacks are just long rectangles.
Right.
And they're easy to tip over.
Yes. Basically a requirement if you have a fight with a map in a library.
Oh, absolutely. Like, if anyone uses fire, a lot of things are going up in smoke. If anyone pushes anybody or anybody gets knocked over, other stacks are going over too. And, you know, even if you win that fight, well, it's not arranged via the Dewey Decimal System anymore, is it?
Right. It's going to take us years to get these all back in order.
And this is only probably useful in more high-level games like Birthright or something more akin to like Civilization or Rogue Trader, where you're sort of at a distance using things like Profit Factor. But you can also have a library as a reward itself. Like, if your country that you are in control of now is able to build or gain possession of the Library of Alexandria, you will be able to, you know, create new kinds of spells, or, you know, your research institutions will be better, or your profit factor increases because you're able to build more kinds of technology because you have access to an STC.
Mm-hmm. So then I think some more general tips. you mentioned this, but keep in mind that locating the library can also be the challenge, right? Especially when you get into more fantastical things where the library might be on another continent or another plane of existence, or might be displaced in time and you need to find when the library exists, not where.
Yeah, if finding the library is a quest in and of itself, then probably that quest is what sort of qualifies you to enter the library, right? If you are able to find it, then you have passed the test and you are now able to access the information within.
You know, or alternatively, the library is easy to find, but it has some exotic requirement to actually like see it or use it or whatever, right? Some mystical thing is required in order to take advantage of the library.
Right. The players may not even necessarily know that there's part of the library or information that they can't access. It could be like hidden extra dimensionally.
Right.
It's a nice way to take a library that they are used to and that they've been in before and expand its capabilities later when they need it.
And I think the general theme here is just if the players have to earn access to the library, they're going to appreciate the information they get out of it that much more.
Right. And it makes it very obvious that this information is important. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been so tough to get.
So then also keep in mind that a library doesn't have to be a stodgy collection of books, right? Like, depending on your setting, a library might serve the same function but look a lot different. You know, in like a Shadowrun or kind of a more technologically advanced setting, it might be like a hacked server that just has terabytes of very valuable data that hasn't necessarily been combed over yet. Or I suppose it's probably in a future setting, so it's like petabytes or whatever.
No, the codecs are much better. Everything is condensed to much smaller bits of data. It's fine.
Okay.
It's megabytes. They fit on 1.44 floppies.
Oh, perfect. you might also have like a library that exists as a group of people, right? So maybe there's a specific band of like a troop of bards who travel together who have just vast knowledge of the world and of history and of various things. The challenge is finding them and then getting them to actually share the information they almost certainly have with you.
And also keeping them alive when obviously they are assassination targets.
Yeah, but they've been assassination targets for a long time.
Yeah, but now you're responsible.
You're involved. Yeah.
Yeah, I love the idea of a society that uses pretty much only oral tradition. So, like, you don't reference books. You have to, like, actually talk to a person.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it could also be one person who knows everything or, you know, knows all of the important, relevant information. Some sort of oracle. This is Book of Eli, basically.
Oh, yeah. Or, I mean, even in just more the Greek fashion of oracle, right, where they are a prophet who can speak through the or through whom the gods can speak, and it just requires, you know, a worthy sacrifice in order to get that information.
Right, they are a prophet who can inhale the volcanic fumes and interpret them.
I said, okay, Greek myth, not Greek history.
For some reason, she's not an oracle anymore. Now that we've moved her, I don't get it.
Now, keep in mind, a library might exist before it is actually in the library. You know, there might be like a looted collection of occult tomes that are being collected and shipped from Paris back to Hitler in Berlin. And you could find that information if you could just get aboard that train before it's locked down by the Third Reich. And then, of course, use it to defeat Hitler.
You could hide with the books. And then when Hitler opens it, hey, success.
Yeah. So I think to wrap this up, the biggest tip to take away here is that you don't have to force the players into a library. If they're just not enjoying it as a narrative device, there are always alternative ways of getting that information to them.
Yeah, there are always alternative facts.
Yeah, just make them up.
Yep, just lie.
You know, there's things like D&D has legend lore spells or bardic knowledge, right? A modern setting has an iPhone and Wikipedia, for example. You know, you don't have to make the knowledge difficult for them to get in order to keep moving your plot forward if they're not enjoying the challenge of and the reward of getting that information.
Right. It can be easy to get. You can also just remind them about particular lore when they come across it and it would be relevant, or, you know, when it would affect their choices in the moment. And you can also just direct that toward the players who are interested in this kind of information. Not everybody needs to be involved in it all the time.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
Shh. We
we finally made it inside the library. All right, well, it's going to be really hard to get my character creation forge running if I can't bang my metal with a hammer or a mallet. What are they?
Anyway, whatever. Let's move on.
How do we build in the forge? Is that an anvil?
That's a hammer and anvil I've got.
It's tongs and like a hot horseshoe, right?
Yep, and one that's of those a bellows. What? I do a lot of character creation forging in here. Obviously, I know the difference between a billows and a bellows, Ishan.
Yeah, obviously. Well, my apprentice does.
Right.
he's the one that works the bellows.
I've got people for that.
Speaking of people,
let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
Yeah, we do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous, M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
All right, so this week we are building the bookworm.
Shane, how do you spell bookworm?
Bookworm. W-Y-R-M.
Oh, of course. I see. So we are some kind of paste-eating larva.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Great. So are we a druid, then we just keep turning into silkworms? Is that it?
We are
done.
Not.
Druid 20.
Okay. Druids don't get a history, so it's a little difficult.
Okay. So what does the bookworm do?
So the bookworm is a... It's a dragon who just really likes knowledge.
Isn't that just a dragon?
Well, yeah, but like dragons have like hordes and like gold and stuff like that. But this is somebody who embraces their draconic heritage, but embraces the hoarding of knowledge, Ishan.
Ah, okay. Sleeps on letters.
Sleeps on the smug satisfaction of knowing everything.
In my armchair here. Let me tell you what you should have done.
Right.
Okay, what's the build?
The build is Dragon Sorcerer 14, Knowledge Cleric 1, Mastermind Rogue 5.
Knowledge Cleric 1, here for obvious reasons, you get very good cantrips like Guidance, which is pretty much bread and butter for knowledge checks. Mm-hmm. And you get expertise in two knowledge skills. History and religion, most likely.
You'll also get some useful level 1 cleric spells, a little bit of healing, bless, those types of things. Then Mastermind Rogue 5, you're here for the expertises, obviously. So make sure you grab Investigation so you can find information once you're in the library, and then get either Arcana or Nature, depending on sort of what most interests you. But note that you'll have to get those from your background, because those aren't skills for the rogue.
And maybe you take Stealth because you want to be quiet because you're in the library.
Yeah, it's very respectful. You'll also get Cunning Action. And then from Mastermind at third level, you get the Master of Intrigue, which I like a lot because it gives you proficiency in the forgery kit. So if you have to steal a page from a book in the library, you can always forge a replacement later, as well as Disguise Kit and Gaming Set, and two languages, which always helps in your research.
I like Gaming Set because... how many times do you see those couched conversations over a game of chess in the park in front of the library where you're actually meeting a contact? Plus, Disguise Kit just lets you be that person who is now looking for different information than someone else was looking for previously.
Well, with your ability to mimic speech patterns after observing them for a minute, then you can also pretend to be from a faraway place.
I mean, that was their speech pattern. Did you not see me...
oh, no, I heard
mimic it.
I heard it.
you get those two languages. I think Knowledge Cleric gives you two as well, so you've got four additional languages, which is helpful because, you know, not everything is going to be in common or English.
It's always better to do the research in the original language.
Oh, absolutely. You don't want to trust those interpreters, which is actually a great plot hook, finding the interpreter or finding the original text that was... interpreted or translated 8,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Then you'll get Master of Tactics, which lets you use your cunning action to take the help action at a range of 30 feet. This is super helpful with a sorcerer who's always trying to maximize the use of their bonus action with spellcasting. You don't have to invest the points into quicken spell in order to still have a useful bonus action.
Yeah, and it also means you can just sort of run through the stacks, you know, helping people who are doing research.
That's right, just tap them on the shoulder. Yeah.
Read faster!
And then in case anybody does tip over those stacks or throws the proverbial book at you, you'll have Uncanny Dodge, which lets you take a reaction to have damage from an attack.
I think that's definitely blocking a blow with a book, a big, thick encyclopedia.
I don't know. I think it might be blocking the damage to the book with your body.
I only took half because I didn't save it all. Oh, I'm sorry, S-A to S-U.
Right.
From sorcerer, you get spellcasting, meta magic, you get sorcery points. You also get turned into a more dragon-y kind of person, which makes sense because you're a worm.
Right, so you get scales and all of that stuff that gives you extra HP, draconic resilience, and then you'll have always-on mage armor. At sixth level, you get elemental affinity, which has been nerfed, so you only add charisma to one damage roll from a spell, but you know it's still fine, still gives you a bonus. And then you can also spend a sorcery point to give yourself resistance to your element for an hour.
And level 14, nice little capstone, you get dragon wings, which lets you access all of those floating libraries.
Or it lets you access the top level of the library tower. You know, everybody else is having to like circle around the outside like a lighthouse, and you just fly straight up.
Yeah, you don't have to use those like rolling ladders, which are a health hazard.
Right.
Do you know how many librarians have died by falling off them or being pushed off them by assassins?
Right. being pushed off them by dragon-winged bookworms?
All right, I'm glad to see the return of beginning at Rogue One.
It's been way too long.
Yes.
So yeah, start Rogue One, then I think take your Cleric One. That'll give you all of those expertises and knowledge skills. You are now thoroughly booky. And then I think you just begin your Worm path. You could take Sorcerer straight to 14 and then finish out Rogue, or you can kind of alternate those levels however you want to. Take what's most exciting next. There's no real rhyme or reason to how you take those 14 Sorcerer and 4 remaining Rogue levels. So Ishan, who is your bookworm?
My bookworm was a bookworm, right? Spent all of her time in the library dreaming about adventures, but never really getting out there into the world. You know, a little bit timid at first until through her research, she realizes her draconic heritage. It was quite a day when she realized that the family she was reading about was actually her own. And lo and behold, they're descended from dragons. And so from there, what does her research turn to but the forbidden section, where she learns how to unleash her draconic potential, becomes a sorcerer, starts slinging spells, and now is out in the world, flying around, still makes constant trips to the library because that is her happy place.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, not objectively funny, but just funny because it's like kind of the same way I was going.
Uh-oh. Well, tell me about your bookworm.
So my bookworm, similarly, you know, believes in the value of knowledge. And when he began manifesting his draconic heritage, kind of became an amateur genealogist. And now spends his time trying to trace and track down his draconic ancestor.
Ancestor.
Exactly. He wants to know exactly when his bloodline was merged with the draconic bloodline and how far back he can trace that.
Wait, so his quest is to find his draconic ancestor and be like, yo, when did you smash?
Yeah. And then also like, why did you do this to me? I'm going to kill you now.
Well, you know, in the meantime, he's just spending all his time on fantasyancestry.com.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, half this stuff is wrong.
He's taken like 6 23andMes, and every time he does it, he gets a different element. It's like, am I a red dragon or a cobalt dragon?
Fingers crossed. Come on, gold. Well, fire. Sorry, buddy. It's brass.
All right. So before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And I just want to say thank you to the handful of new patrons that we've got in the last month or so during the hashtag podraising push. I have also been following along podraising and giving some money to podcasts that I've been listening to for a long time. So we appreciate everybody who's taken the plunge and joined recently, as well as our longtime supporters.
Very happy to have all of you on board.
All right. What do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about railroading.
Do we have to?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I don't even get a choice. You're just going to force me to do railroading? I'm being railroaded on this podcast.
No, you're not at all. You have choices and options here, Shane. You could take the left path or the right path.
They all lead to episode 192, which is railroading. All right, what are we doing in the character creation forge?
Well, how do you think you're going to get to railroading? We're building the Iron Horse.
All right, that's it for episode 191 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening. Total Party Thrill is brought to you by Kobold Press. Want to learn the secrets of elven magic or blast your enemies with battle magic?
Also, yep.
What about building cunning mechanical servants with clockwork magic?
Absolutely do I want to do that.
Well, with the Deep Magic series from Kobold Press, it has all of this and more for 5th edition D&D.
So, does it have time magic?
Oh, yes.
Does it have rune magic?
Loads.
Does it have illumination?
It's so bright.
Are there nearly 20 PDFs and new ones coming out all the time?
It's almost like you have this copy right in front of you.
It's almost like I know these things because I got it from the library. So in the Deep Magic series, you will find new magic schools, you'll find sorcerer's origins, you'll find warlock patrons, you will find feats, you will find spells, you will find magic items, and much more.
Aren't books great?
I love books.
Yeah. I almost wish I could copy books very quickly, easily, so I have multiple copies, so I have multiple books, so I could sleep on them. An entire bed full of books that I could print out.
I just wish I could take my book in any form that I wanted it on any device so I could read it anywhere that I was.
If only there were some sort of portable document file type that would allow you to do such a thing.
It's a format.
I don't know what you're talking about. Pretty sure I just invented a portable document file type.
Oh, did you? Okay. Tell me about GIFs.
I believe they're GIFs.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, graphical image file types.
All right. Well, if you'd like to learn more about magic and less about document types, you can pick up the Deep Magic series for 5th edition at www.koboldpress.com.